Miss Shorty. Can y'all hear me? My name's Lori. I'm an alcoholic and a dope fiend. Thank you for the introduction, Marianne. Marianne, y'all need to get her out here to speak sometime. She's phenomenal. Thank you, everybody, for coming out tonight. And let's see. Let me ask God to get on board because I don't know what's needed in this room. So let's see, a general way, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born, like everybody else, not unique. So I was born in California to a family that I don't know particularly if there's alcoholism, drug addiction in my birth family, because when I was 18 months old, me and my biological brothers were torn apart from the family and went into foster care. And so we went with this family, we went with that family, we went with this family. We got split up, we got put back together. So as far back as I can remember, I don't really have a strong root in family until I got to AA. But there's a little story in the middle. So let me watch the clock. So, I'm not going to say that my childhood upbringing or anything like that, my victim story, quote, everybody's got a hard life. Like, life happens for all of us. I'm not going to say that those things made me alcoholic or a drug addict, but I will say they made me thirsty. Because when I got sober, I found when I started doing inventory, I had deep, deep rooted resentments and fear that stemmed all the way back to those childhood things. Because I was given away over and over and over, it's never what really happens to me in my life that's the problem. It's what I think about what happens to me that's the problem. And so from as early as I can remember, early, I had a deep, deep sense of I'm disposable, I'm unlovable, I'm not wanted, I'm not good enough, I'm not worthy, because I kept getting uprooted and given away to somebody else. And then we don't want her. Go back to foster care. And we don't want them. Finally, this poor family was going to adopt me. No, they're great. But so this family was going to adopt me and my brothers from foster care to keep the children together. And we came to Texas and this podunk little town that shall remain nameless. And that didn't work out. Once again, this family had one child of their own, and they went from having one small child to having four overnight, which you can imagine, like, that's a lot, a lot. And especially three children that are stacked in ages. My younger brother was still in diapers. I was 18 months. My older brother was like a year ahead of me. So we were all a handful, and that family couldn't keep all three of us. So they dispersed us out between that family. So I went with this aunt and uncle, and my brother went with this one, and my brother went with this one, and we were just trying to keep in the same semi-family unit, and that didn't work out either. One of my brothers went back to our biological mother. One of our other brothers went to a different family to be adopted, and then this family actually ended up adopting me. Like I said, they had their own child. So I have my adopted brother. He's the natural biological child. I'm the adopted one. So still, from as far back as I can remember, I felt like on the outside looking in at this family, this unit, this thing that I don't belong to, and a deep fear of, is it going to stay this time? What if they send me away again? Like, what's going to happen? I had no roots of, like, stability. And that's okay. Like, 'cause a lot of kids don't, that doesn't make you alcoholic, But what it did make me is freaking crazy. Like, I have no tools to deal with life. I know I'm full of fear. I don't feel loved. I don't feel wanted. I'm not sure what's going to happen next, and I'm terrified. And that my childhood was kind of like that on a consistent basis. And fast forward, so I came to live with this family when I was 4. My adoption wasn't finalized until I was 7 years old. And I hear, like, I don't know anything about parenting, but I hear that, like, kids' belief systems develop, like, around that 7-8-year-old mark. Like, that's when they start, like, settling in. And mine were pretty skewed already at that time. I remember the day that I was adopted was December 16th, and I was 7 years old, and they waited till Christmas morning to tell me. And I remember Christmas morning, my grandma of my adopted family came up to me, and she gave me this gift, and there was, like, this little Kimberly cheerleader doll that I wanted, and I unwrapped the gift, and I got the Kimberly doll, and I was so excited. And then my grandma says, read the note. And so I read this piece of paper, and it says, you're ours. Your adoption's final. And I just started bawling. And I went into the hallway, and I'll never forget, there was like this lamp in this dark hallway, and I just slid down the wall in fetal position, and I was holding this Kimberly doll, and I was crying. And my grandma's like, what's wrong? What's wrong? And like as a kid, you know, putting your words to your big old feelings that you don't know how to explain. I remember the feeling, though, viscerally, today. I was like, but now I'll never go back to my real family. Like, now this is permanent. And that's scary, you know? And it's like I was happy and I was sad at the same time. It was so final. There was something so final. And I wasn't used to final. And so, anyway, fast forward, that family that I lived with, so my adoption was final at 7. And then when I was 11 years old, and it's interesting because I've read about this since I've been sober, but like people that are in estranged families like that are adopted or foster care and stuff, there's some sort of psychological word for it, but kids objectifying a parent, like in the form of a higher power, and it's like you always love the one that left you, or like you. And so I did that as a child. My biological father, his name was Carrie, and I would watch these planes fly at night, and you see the light in the air. I still look at them to this day, and I would sit and watch these planes fly by the airport, and I would say, someday my Carrie daddy's coming to save me. Someday my Carrie daddy's coming to get me. You know, when things were bad, my Carrie daddy's going to come get me. And I guess as a kid, like, that was me trying to have a higher power, you know, and I believed it, you know. But when I was 11, with this adopted family, my mother of that family that adopted me was totally nuts, okay? And I'm saying she was a sick woman, okay? She got proved to be an unfit mother. Those parents divorced. She went into a nut house. And it was extremely traumatic and, lots of trauma, that relationship. But she went into a nut house. My dad, back in the 80s, it was unheard of for the father to get the children in Texas. And my dad proved her an unfit mother and got custody of me and his biological son. So we were living with him. And it was just another split, you know, like it's showbiz for me. My brother had a different reaction. But this was the thing. Like, when I was 11, my adopted dad got a phone call, and it was my Carrie daddy on the phone. And, like, my whole life, I've waited for this call, right? Like, my Carrie daddy's coming to save me. And he wanted to talk to me. And this is, like, the thing that, like, snapped me. I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to hurt my dad's feelings, the one that adopted me, that's like raising me. I didn't want to hurt his feelings. I know, right? It's awesome. No, it's perfect. It's perfect. I didn't want to hurt. I didn't want to hurt my Dave, my adopted dad's feelings, and I didn't know what to say to my carry daddy. Like, I'd rehearsed this my whole life. Like, are you coming back to get me? Why did you leave? What do you look like? Do we look alike? Like, I had all these things I wanted to say as a kid, you know? And the moment came, and I freaking froze. And I didn't know what to do. And this is the man that I'm going to see every day for the rest of my life. So I abandoned myself in that moment. And I said no, because I didn't know what to say to him. And 2 weeks later, my carry daddy died. He was electrocuted. It was a total accident. He wasn't sick. He was healthy. You know what I mean? And so my dad, my adopted dad, came in and told me the bad news. And it was the first time in my life I'd ever seen this man cry. And I snapped. Like, I shut down completely at first. I just completely detached. It was like my higher power died. You know, like I couldn't, as a child, I had no tools to really wrap my head around any of it. And that's when I personally started acting out. And I mean, acting out a lot. So I started messing with boys that I had no business messing with, older, messing with drugs, messing with alcohol, stealing cars, breaking in houses, getting in fights, cops being called, running away. Lots of wayward behavior, let's say. So I was a terror. I was a total terror. But it made me feel power when I was completely powerless. You know, I look back now and I thought it was a sense of power for me as a child in a completely crazy world, not knowing how to survive it or talk to anybody about it. Or I was just angry. I was so angry at life. So angry at life. And victim. Oh my God, you know, if you had my life, you'd be using drugs too. Like, just dripping with self-pity. And I snapped. And like I said, and my poor dad that adopted me, that he didn't know what to do with a girl like me. You know, he's a single dad with two kids, and his son, my brother, is a total freaking angel. You know, he's the golden child, and I'm like the bad girl. And so I pushed him to the limits. There was some physical abuse. I look back now and see, like, my dad snapped. You know, I drove. I'm not saying what he did was right or anything, but I get where he was coming from. I pushed him. He did not know what to do with me. And so at that point in time, I'd gotten into another fight with this. I was 14 and this girl was 17. She was in high school. And I followed her to her house and I beat the shit out of her in her own living room. And bad. And I got in major trouble. I got put on probation for criminal trespass, assault, and harassment when I was 14 years old. I got 4 years probation. And then I kept getting in trouble, so they sent me to juvie. So I was in juvie jail, you know, and thinking, like, the whole image I had built up was like, I'm tough girl, F you, I don't need anybody. Nobody's been here. I'm doing this myself. Like, that was my armor. And if I'm honest, like, secretly, I'm dying inside. I'm terrified. No, I don't know what to do. And now I've built up such a strong image that, like, you don't mess with Lori at school and at, like, just a bully. And it was such a facade. It was such a facade, you know? And so I kept getting in trouble, so I went to juvie jail, and then one day came, and my probation officer showed up. She picked me up from juvie and handcuffed me in the car, and we drove miles and miles and miles to even more Podunk, West Texas. I didn't know where we were going. She wasn't telling me. I didn't get to say goodbye to my dad, my brother, my friends. I didn't get to pack anything. No idea what's happening to me. And they sent me to this girls' home called Girlstown, and I became a ward of the state. And so, again, that whole victim rage welled up in me. And the next time I saw my father, I was like, fine, this is how you've always wanted it. Just you and Jeff, you know, get rid of me and throw me away like everybody else. Like I was just oozing rage. And so I live in this girls' home for 4 years with 75 other wayward girls like me. And you can imagine how that was. That was crazy. But during that time, I mean, like, there's no, like, I'm locked up in a girls' home. We get to bus to the public school. You know, like, there's no stoplight in the town. It's a really small town, really, really small town. And so the town kids were like, oh, girls' town girls. You know, like, we had a reputation before we even got to school. And I capitalized on it, right? I played my tough girl role. And I did that until it didn't work anymore. There was people that showed up in my life during that period of time that saw something in me I didn't see in myself, which I don't believe I'd had that before, where somebody, like, believed in me. And so, you know, sometimes, especially too in the rooms, you know, we can't even imagine a different experience than the one we're having. And somebody outside of you will see it before you do. Like, trust it. You know, just trust it. Like, why not? Like, what do you got to lose? And so there were people in my life that came along my path during that time. Like I said, they saw something in me. I had a high school teacher. I call her my drama mama because she taught drama, theater. And I, you know, I was doing my tough girl role or whatever, and she came up and she's like, you need to audition for the one-act play. And I'm like, I'm not auditioning for your stupid fucking play. And she goes, it'll get you out of Girlstown. I was like, winner auditions. So I would do anything to get out of Girlstown. Like, I was in, can y'all see me with a cow? Like, I was in 4-H, I was in FFA, I was in FCA, like, I was in band. Like, I was in everything I could get into just to get out of Girlstown. Like, I always had a con running for something just to get away. And so when she said that, I did that. I showed up to these auditions, and I got cast in a role. And it's so funny because I still remember my lines. I only had four of them. But it was this angry, rageful painter character. And she had four lines, and they all started with, I hate everything in the world, but most of all, I hate, and she just lists all these fucking resentments out, right? I didn't know anything about anything, but I knew resentments. I mean, I knew rage, you know? So I just played this character. It's like second nature for me. And I started winning all these awards for, like, best actress. And colleges were coming after me to, like, be on their, like, we'll give you full scholarship. Like, it was crazy, right? But that lady, my drama mama teacher, she kind of took me under her wing. She'd let me smoke, which I love to do. Love smoke cigarettes. You can't do that at Girlstown, by the way. And so I was always sneaking around, smoking cigarettes, just doing whatever I could do. And anyway, she saw something in me, you know, and so for, like, a mentor, I guess, out of the blue, my higher power put this woman in my life, and, you know, she nursed me through high school in a way, and I did. I went down acting, the acting road, and thought I was going to be an actress someday and all this jazz. But what it taught me looking back was to trust another human being. It was like the first time in my life I could really trust another human being. And fast forward after that, like, I graduated high school. I decided to go to college, and I've been offered two full scholarship rides for theater, for acting, which is awesome, right? But what do? I'm dating this guy, and he's going to go to San Marcos, Texas, way far away to the big shitty, And so I follow him. I give up two full scholarships for a $350 scholarship to go to college here in San Marcos. And my probation officer told me the best news I'd ever heard in my life. She goes, "You do realize that's the number one party school in Texas." And I was like, "Really?" I was like, "Ah!" You know, like, that was my scholarship. I had no idea. And I just got out of Girls Town. So, like, forget scholarship, forget boys, forget school. I found alcohol. Like, really. It wasn't like when I was still in cars and just, you know, piddling around. I started drinking daily. It turns out that, like, they want you to go to class in college or you get an incomplete. And so I had all these incompletes and Fs. Like, you know, my GPA started, like, my drinking was going up and my GPA was going down. And then I was like, wow, college is really interfering with my drinking, so I better stop going to college. So I quit going to college, and I was driving to Austin 4 days a week to drink, go to 6th Street, you know? It was partying at the time, except my friends didn't drink like I drank. They would, like, sober up and, like, oh, I feel so horrible. So they would stop and, like, go to class and stuff. So those friends started falling away, and I started hanging out with more and more people that drink like I drink. And I drank myself out of college. I drank myself out of a couple jobs. And then I met a guy, another guy, because it's what I do. And I was drinking in the morning. I mean, it was on me. The obsession was on me. The obsession, oh my God, was on me. And I'm drinking one of these big 44-ounce Sonic cups full of whiskey. He's a heroin addict. I didn't mention that. So he's like shooting heroin. I'm drinking it early in the morning. Like, it's love at first sight, right? And he's like disgusted with me. He's disgusted with me. And I'm disgusted with him. And I'm like, I would never put a needle in my arm. He's like, "You're drinking at 9 a.m. It's like, fuck you. Ah, you know, another day in paradise. So it's just spiraling. And I'm begging him, right, like, to get me high. Like, I don't know how to shoot up. Like, I'm just an alcoholic. But I started saying things like, well, I would never do this. I would never. I mean, I'm just alcoholic, right? Like, and I would wear it like a badge. Like, I would say alcoholic like it was a badge of honor, because I could drink really big grown men under the table and, like, still be totally here, you know? And I'm a blackout drinker, but, like, I didn't even know the word blackout till I got to AA. And I would just say, oh, I lost time again last night. The last thing I remember is blah, blah, blah. And they're like, God, that was, like, at 11 o'clock. You know, and I was like, oh, well, you know, like, I'm here now. Like, I have no idea what happened during the gap. And then those gaps got longer and longer and longer and longer. And I would just think I lost time. And I did lose time. I lost a lot of time, actually. But apparently it's called a blackout. And it's a thing that we alcoholics do. So anyway, fast forward. Got in a relationship with this heroin addict. Begged him to turn me on to heroin. He shot me up, and I was hooked. Immediately. I started using heroin daily, and I thought it was controlling my drinking, because my drinking just, like, took a backseat. And I'm like, hey, this is not bad. And then it got really, really bad. Like, really bad. Like, falling off a cliff bad, because I'm a real alcoholic. I'm a real addict. And I started checking things off my never, never list. I did start losing everything, my apartment, my car, my jobs. I started working in Jack Shacks, which are really sordid places. I started doing things with my body I said I would never do, humiliating things. You know, like, I hated myself to the core, and I couldn't stop. I remember going to a methadone clinic, and I mean, it was early on in my heroin use, because I was so hooked so fast immediately, and I needed more and more and more just to get well and stay well. And I went to this methadone clinic, and I was telling the truth. Like, I don't know why I did that, but it happened, and I was telling the truth. And I asked them, you know, to, like, help me get off heroin, and they said I hadn't been using long enough. And I was just like, what? Like, it took everything I had in, like, 3 months. What are you talking? Like, I'm going to die. So I started the last 18 months of my drinking and using. I was in and out of treatment, in and out of treatment. I went through Austin Recovery 5 times. I went through another treatment center in Waco 1 time. And the last time I came to Austin Recovery, well, I was homeless then. You know, I was already sleeping behind convenience stores and auto body shop. And I just wanted to die. Like, I wanted it to stop. I couldn't stop, no matter how hard I tried. And then I would tell myself, like, if I could just quit smoking crack and doing heroin, like, then I can just drink alcohol like a normal person, you know? Like, I really wanted to be able to control and enjoy my drinking, and it turns out, like, I can't. And so the last time I was at Austin Recovery, like, I begged them. I was in the waiting room. I'd lost my bowels. My left eyeball, like, floats around in my socket. Just weird, looking all over the place. My hands are cramped up. I'm in horrible, horrible shape. And I'm begging them. And, you know, and the guy, I can't remember his name. Cindy was there, and there's another guy. And he had 17 years sober. And I'll never forget his face. I'll never forget his face. Because he remembered me from the last time I was in there. And I begged him, please, please, please. And he's like, what are you going to do? Like, you... I mean, I'll pop into detox, rest my liver, and then I leave, and I think I got it, you know? And over and over and over, because I didn't know anything about the steps. I didn't know anything about powerlessness. I just thought I'd just rush headlong into trying harder this time and meaning it. This time I mean it. And lack of power is my dilemma. And so he's like, what are you going to do different this time? And I was like, this time I'll stay. I don't know who said those words, but it came out of my mouth. And he left the room, and I don't know if he went and prayed or if he went and talked to management. I don't know what he did, and it seemed like forever. And it may have been like 30 seconds. I have no idea. But he came back in, and he said, come on, we got a bed for you. And it still chokes me up. Because that guy that day, I was like, you don't understand. That was my favorite flag. You don't understand. I waved that flag. If I leave here, I'm going to die. Like, I was going to go do the be all end all of shots and just get it done. And so I stayed. And it's funny because this week is Valentine's week. I was in fucking treatment that time. It was Valentine's week. You know why I remember? Because I got a huge resentment because I didn't get, like, Valentine Princess or whatever they had going on at Austin Recovery. Which is great because, like, you get tools to use while you're here. And, like, I learned how to do a 10-step inventory on a freaking Valentine's resentment, right? Where my pride was affected, my self-esteem, like, I'm not a da-da-da-da. It's not a popularity contest. But, you know, like, the things we think and, like, anyway, God, I feel like I'm rambling so much. There's so much good things about recovery I want to say. So I get out of there, and I get, like, I don't know, 52, 54 days. So not that long sober. I'm going to meetings. I'm doing AA. I got a sponsor. I'm working through the steps, and I think, like, I got it. Like, this is the I feel amazing because the obsession that was on me, all, like, that parasite takes over the host and makes me, like, it's uncontrollable. But for that to be removed and gone is, like, the biggest miracle of my life. Unbelievable. Like, if that's all you got when you got sober, I'd be good. That's just scratching the surface. Like, that's the first gift. And then it's like, can you hear me now? And so I thought I was doing fantastic, and I got 50-something days or whatever, and I'm in a sober house, and, like, you know, that really wasn't sober, but I was like, I've got a roof over my head, and I was sober. Like, it, you know, the book says that we can go anywhere, we can job or no job, whatever. like, we can, you know, as long as we're spiritually fit. And I thought I was. And then suddenly the thought crossed my mind that I could just have a drink. It's in the book, but I didn't know the book yet, you know? So like that thought got on me and like creeped in and snuck through the back door. And instead of like calling myself, like I had a total mental blank spot. And like, I don't even drink wine. And I was like, I could have a glass of wine. I don't even drink wine. So a box and a half wine later, I'm in a blackout with a stolen card at an ATM and I'm buying speed. I don't even do speed, but I'm gonna do it today, right? Like that's, I go zero to fucking nothing overnight, like so quick. It's on me. I'm going. I am so powerless over that. I cannot safely use alcohol or drugs in any form. Any form. I can't pop it, short it, snort it, shoot it, drink it, lick it, suck it, fuck. Like, I can't use it in any form. Oh, it's holistic. It's sold at the head shop. I don't care. I can't use it safely in any form. I don't even want a chance giving this away because of some hip new thing that's come out in 2020. You know what I mean? Like, it's so not worth it. I have an allergy of the body. I have a body that cannot handle this shit, and I got a mind that will not leave it alone. I have to have something to interrupt that, and no human aid can do it for me. Oh my God, we're so screwed. We're so screwed. Like, that's the condition I'm in, you know? Like, that's the condition we're in. So that day, it was a bad day. Like, I had already died. I had this incredible overdose story that I'm not going to go into. I've died three times. But the last one, like, I should not have my mental faculties. I had no oxygen to my, like, I just the fact that I'm here. But I didn't get it at the time. I didn't get it. You know, you're, like, stunned for a minute, like, what just happened? Oh, I'm getting arrested from the hospital and going to jail? It's a bad day. Like, you're clueless. It was just another really bad day. And I was like, oh, the cops are out to get me. Like, victim, victim, victim. Never registering that, like, I was dead. And the disease just reboots itself. That programming comes on. It's like, I'm fighting the cops. I'm fighting the EMS people. You can't take me. I'm not paying for the ambulance. And, like, just... stop. Just stop, you know? I can't stop. And so when my last trip to Austin Recovery and that guy got me in, just those little moves of the needle on the dial, which I think is such amazing grace through people like you in the rooms. They brought meetings into the detox just like this, and there was two cats that came in from AA, and I remember in the detox, the guy was talking about powerlessness and unmanageability, and I was so angry. I was like, how can I be powerless over this inanimate object? Like, I was just, it's such a mind fuck, you know? I was so angry. I'm not powerless. And he's like, well, then don't pick up the first drink. And I was like, how do you do that? And he goes, that's powerlessness. And the penny dropped. Like, I got it. Oh, that's powerlessness. I can't stop drinking and yet don't pick up the first drink. Like, how do you do that? How do you not pick up the first drink or drug when this thing is nonstop driving the bus telling you go, 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 go? You have no choice. And then I found out I'm lost power, choice, and control. And I'm just like, the lights are coming on, you know? But like I said, I didn't stay sober. Like, self-knowledge avails me nothing. And these old cats kept telling me, like, oh, you know, there's this 6 a.m. meeting called Keep First Things First, which is my home group, by the way. And I'm like, 6 a.m.? I'm still up sometimes. I'm a night owl and blah. I had all these reasons why I couldn't do something so unreasonable at such an ungodly hour. And one of my friends, though, in the rooms, he nailed me, right? He said, I thought you said you were willing to go to any lengths. And I was like, oh, you have to pull out that card, you know? And I was like, fine. If I go, will you shut up about it? And he's like, yeah. So I was like, okay, fine. I can do anything once. I mean, that's how I lived. What are those pills? Oh, who cares? Let me have them. Like, it doesn't matter. And so I showed up to the 6 a.m. meeting. And I tell you what, that was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Not only because it was so early, but I walked in that room and my life changed forever. Unrecognizable. There's a woman that shared in that meeting that rung my bell in a way that nobody had ever rang my bell in my entire life. She loved me enough to tell me the truth. I asked her to be my sponsor. And I was like, this is what I'm doing. I started telling her all these great AA things I'm doing, and I'm working with this other lady. And she goes, I don't sponsor people with two sponsors. I was like, ugh. Nobody's ever talked to me that way before. And I was like, why? And she goes, because you're just going to look for the answer you want to hear. And all I have is the truth. And so I was like, oh. So she said my first assignment was to go tell my other sponsor that, like, I've got a new sponsor. I was so scared. Like, I'm breaking up with this lady, you know. She's going to be so sad. I was so terrified. But I was more terrified of not following instructions from this woman that just gave me an assignment. So I went to this previous lady. Her name was Mercy. God had mercy on my soul. She's still around today. It's great. I went to her, and I was, like, breaking up with her as a sponsor. And she was like, good. I've got, like, 14 other girls I'm working with. It's no problem. Like, I thought it was going to be the end of the world because it's all about me. Not true. So I started working with this woman, Tareem. And she took me through the steps, and she took me through the steps quickly and thoroughly, directly out of the book. She said, I don't care what you think. I don't care what you feel. It's about what you do. This is a program of action. It's not just a program of action. It's a spiritual program of action. And so if anybody has any problem with the God thing or the spiritual thing, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what we think. It doesn't matter what we feel. It matters what we do. If you take the steps, you will have your own experience. And that is gold. Nobody can take it from you. Nobody can give it to you. That is yours. And it comes from your actions towards a higher power. And that's what happened in my experience. I gave myself to this power that I didn't believe, like, trust. I was angry that it abandoned me over and over in my childhood. I was angry, where were you when I was drinking? I was angry I didn't become an actress. I was angry about everything. But I had nothing left to lose. I'd lost everything. And the grace of willingness was given, and suddenly I was teachable, like Marianne said. And I did every single thing this woman told me to do. She was God-guided. She wasn't just bossing me around. Like, a sponsor's not a boss. A sponsor's a guide through the steps. She took me through the work. I had a profound awakening after my fifth step. And then in step 6, where it says we're entirely ready to have God, there's more to the sentence, but are you entirely ready to have God? Because that's what happened. And then 7's a work in progress. I continually come up with more stuff being revealed. More is revealed. This isn't a one and done process. Step 8, step 9, I had powerful, powerful experiences making amends. It doesn't matter what you think, you will be scared. It doesn't matter how you feel. It matters what we do. We're here to set our lives in order, and there's more work ahead of that. You know, you can trust the people that went before you along this path. They are guides. They are guides. And then daily living, 10, 11, and 12. I get to be here sober. I've had an incredibly difficult year, like Marianne alluded to. Life hits all of us. Life on life's terms hits all of us. If it wasn't for my higher power and my friends in the fellowship, I have no idea. You guys have given me tools now to live. Not just live sober or be dry, like sobriety, like, I have an amazing, unrecognizable life, and you guys have given me that. I'm so, so grateful to be sober. It is the best thing that's ever happened to me. And if you're new, keep coming back. But don't, meetings are great. They're wonderful. They're fantastic. Please, please, please go to them. It's like boot camp, you know? And working with your sponsors like boot camp. But when outside of the class, in the lab of life, in the real world, that's not the time to be learning for the first time, right? If you get a resentment in here, ask somebody how to work out your resentment. If you're afraid what's going to happen when you leave here, ask somebody to work with you with fear. You know, like everybody wants the same thing for each other, which is recovery. We can live sober and it can be amazing. And I'm going over time. Thank you so, so, so much for having me.